On the Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doc Kirby.
Welcome to On the Bookshelf. We've got a real treat for you today. Three different shorter interviewers. We're going to be talking about an airplane that ditched into the sea in 1962 and the incredible true story of how the captain of that flight managed to save most of the passengers and crew. Then we're going to take a look at the 50th anniversary of the Lunar Rover, the one and only automobile in space. And finally, we'll take a look at the weird ties that bind Marilyn Monroe, John F. Kennedy, Dorothy Kilgallen, and Bobby Kennedy. That's all today on The Bookshelf. First, we'll be talking to Eric Lindner. Since 2015, the attorney, businessman, and D.C. native has been teaching ethics in action at Georgetown University, a course that dissects the NASA Challenger disaster. He's married to Captain Murray's daughter. They live on California's Central Coast. You can learn more about it at tigerinthesea.com. The book, Tiger in the Sea, The Ditching of Flying Tiger 923 and the Desperate Struggle for Survival, from Lions Press. That's L-Y-O-N-S. As I've said, we've got an amazing story to investigate today. We don't really think much about planes having to ditch in the ocean anymore, but in the early 1960s, on this particular day, the conditions were all wrong. It was, if you will, to use that overused cliche, kind of the perfect storm for them in the middle of the storm. And so, Eric, I know that you have an inside track on this because the captain of the airplane would have been your father-in-law. That's an interesting connection.
Thank you so much for having me on. There are so many interesting aspects of this story. I'm not sure where to start. One of them is the Alabama connection, which is amazing.
Yes.
But the plane itself... you're right. It was what's called a reciprocating engine. Mm-hmm. It was a prop and piston engine, which was designed in 1939. And it's fair to say, objectively, it was on its last legs because they stopped making it. But it was up there flying and had four engines. And you're right, horrible weather in the sea, horrible weather in the sky, just human mistakes, everything that could happen, Murphy's Law, if you will, happened. And yet, crew and the passengers, many of them, and responders, performed heroically and miraculously to save a lot of lives.
And the way you tell it, we don't know really until people are rescued who made it and who didn't. And even at the very last minute, there are people that are lost. This was not a private plane. This was a regular international flight. You had 68 passengers from elementary school children all the way up to senior citizens. You had a full crew, several what they used to call stewardesses, flight hostesses, captain, your father-in-law, the engineer, the navigator, all of this, a full crew in this plane. And as one by one the engines start having problems, all of them start getting pretty nervous, right?
Most of them start getting pretty nervous, that's for sure. Captain Murray certainly didn't seem to be nervous. He'd seen a lot, and I mean seen a lot. He'd been shot at over the Red Sea. He'd been stalked, if you will, by Russian MiGs. He crashed a couple times, saved miraculously, student pilot. So he'd lost engines before. So he was cool. And there were a bunch of other people who were cool. The chief stewardess, as she was called, you know, retired school teachers, women. I mean, unexpected. But mostly, you're right, there was a lot of anxiety, although a lot of it was contained. A lot of, if you will, bravura and paratroopers. These guys were, I'm rewatching Band of Brothers. These same sort of paratroopers, mm-hmm. right? Tough, mm-hmm. tough guys. Five of them were from Alabama.
Yes.
Six of them were from Alabama was number two. East Gadsden, Birmingham, and Montgomery. They were joking about hitting the water, joking about going on a raft trip. You know, a lot of that was trying to cover their anxiety, cover their fear, because the plane was hurtling towards the sea. It was pitch black. The waves were crazy. The winds were none short of a hurricane. The winds were heavier than the same ones that hit New Orleans. And, of course, at that time, people were smoking. It was a contained, these were big guys for the most part, tucked in little seats. Smoking was permitted, so it was this long aluminum tube filled with smoke hurtling down towards the sea in pitch black night. It was something.
Going 120 miles an hour headed toward 20-foot waves, knowing that the floatability of this little aluminum tube is not going to be terrific, that there are lifeboats on board, and they had talked about having some drills, and as there, it seems like I remember reading that after the second engine flared out, that they began talking about what we need to do when we crash land in the water. But when they did crash land, there were issues with lifeboats trying to get them out, trying to get people into them. I think one of the things that shocked me most as I'm reading your story is that at some point there's a lot of them in one particular raft, and they begin to realize we're upside down on the raft. Raft is upside down underneath it, and that's why we're not in it, but we're kind of gently floating on top of it. And at that point, there's no way to fix it. You can't say, okay, buddy, out, and let's flip this sucker over.
Right.
There were just one issue after another that was going up against these guys, but the vast majority of them never gave up and just hung in there. And it's happening. The timing of this is what's important, too, isn't it? Because it's happening in September of 1962, and in October of 1962, we have the Cuban Missile Crisis. So that juxtaposition is part of the problem with getting rescue ships there and all of that. And plus the fact that some of these guys are on a mission that's not exactly well known. Bases in Germany, just in case. Right.
You're right. The backdrop of the paratroopers, you know, back then, I mean, it was a tough course. It wasn't the Green Berets. The SEALs hadn't SEALs were just started in 1962, just getting going. The Green Berets were there, the Rangers. But this was, back then, this was considered a special force. The pass-through rate was about 15%, washout rate was about 85%, and it was tough. They trained in Georgia during the summer. They trained in North Carolina during the summer. And normally they got leave. Normally they got 2 weeks leave before posting, but these guys didn't get any leave. And they were all guys, and they got no leave. They just said, pack your gear, get ready, you're going overseas. And then 5 days after graduating Fort Bragg Jump School, they're off on a plane. And they'd only had five jumps. I mean, their sixth jump was in the ocean, out of the hatch. It was crazy stuff. And you're right, the backdrop, you know, there's so many connections here. So this is a Lockheed plane, it was a great plane. It was built very sturdy, helped to win the war. But the Lockheed planes were also the ones that were snapping the pictures over Cuba. You're right. And they knew what was going on, Kennedy, and all those guys knew what was going on down in Soviet Union. But it wasn't until, you're right, a couple weeks later that the Cuban Missile Crisis really broke. But at the time, there was already another crisis. That was the Berlin Wall, which went up at the end of 61.
Right.
And so the paratroopers were sent over there to reinforce in case the Soviets decided they wanted not just to throw up a wall, but they wanted to basically just swallow up Berlin.
A couple of other problems. One of them is the life preservers that they're given.
They did not have lives. There's sort of a several-act play. The first was in the air, and then they make it miraculously. Murray miraculously, with his great help of his crew and passengers, lands, which is amazing. It's called a controlled water landing. And then everything that was supposed to be there wasn't. The rafts were supposed to be there. They weren't. The life preservers were supposed to work. They didn't. They didn't have lights. Today we have reversible rafts. We have slides. We have all lights. Didn't have any of that stuff back then. Flashlight, you know, you hit the water at 120 miles an hour. Even if you're holding the flashlights, they go everywhere, right?
Right.
So it was the safety equipment at the time was, let's just say, it left a lot to be desired, and it didn't work.
Right.
It wouldn't have worked in the best of circumstances, and these weren't the best of circumstances.
Right. Right. The ship that was really the hero of, or I should say one of the heroes, because your father-in-law was one of the heroes, the fact that they held it all together and kept people together and managed to get so many of them rescued. But the ship that came to the rescue was the Celerina.
A remarkable story, because, you know, all this, the height of the Cold, it really was the height of the Cold War. And Canada had its lone aircraft carrier. They don't have any more aircraft carriers anymore. United States was out there, Air Force, Navy. And the ones that played the key role, really the rescue role, were the neutral Swiss. And they couldn't communicate with NATO because NATO didn't want to give away their codes to the Soviet Union. The Baltic Fleet was monitoring. And I know you're a musician.
Yeah.
The real hero, there were several heroes, but the real hero was a guy who played something like a bass tuba or something. There's actually a photograph of him on the website. He watched the survivors. They could not board. The water was too rough. We all know what it's like. Most of us do, right? Trying to board, just get on dock, right? During water.
Right.
It's really heavy, choppy, getting on. This was 25 degree chop. This was 25 feet chop. and it couldn't board. And so this Swiss carpenter, he had no duty. It was a pure Good Samaritan. He jumped down. He didn't know these people from Adam. He said, I can't watch this anymore. He jumped down with a knife between his teeth, like Errol Flynn, knocked his teeth out.
Right.
And without him, really, no one would have survived, really. I mean, Murray got them on the water. Murray kept them alive with a lot of other things. But if the Swiss had not come to the rescue in literally the nick of time, no one would have survived.
Yeah.
No one would survive.
Yeah. They shared their limited resources. This was not designed to be a rescue ship. He just happened to have brought his family along with him, the captain of the ship.
Right.
And they all gave up their clothes and their beds and blankets and everything else and their food, trying to keep warm everybody up. No. I mean, it really is. It's a great story.
Thank you. And it is a story. I'm a baboon, could have written it. It was material. It was all there. And I do want to come back to the Alabama connection because it's amazing, right? You got Joe Hoffer. I think he's in the book at List of Tuscaloosa, but
yeah.
And there were mixed. Sometimes the Army got it wrong sometimes. One report has him Tuscaloosa, one report has him Birmingham, but we know he's from Alabama. And we also know the pilot, the first pilot to see the raft, to see Captain Murray's flashlight, flashed by Private Joe Hoffer, was Joseph K. Lewis. On his checkout flight, that was his very first flight as an Air Force captain from Tuscaloosa. So imagine that.
Wow.
This pilot looking down, first time in the pilot seat, and he sees a flash beam coming up from a fellow Alabaman. I think that's just talk about like, holy Moses, how does that happen?
Yeah.
But it did happen. First time private, first time pilot, and they connect and that guided the ship, the Swiss ship, to the raft. Remarkable. Just remarkable.
But you do a wonderful job in fleshing out the passengers for us so we feel like we know them. Therefore, when we lose some of them along the way, we're sad because now we know these people. And that's a lovely thing, too. These are not just anonymous people that died anonymously. They had lives and they had careers and they had loved ones. And some of them had loved ones with them.
Thank you for saying that.
I know that people can go to, is it tigerinthesea.com to find out more?
They can. Thank you very much. Tigerinthesea.com. They can follow. Thank you so much. Yeah, I think they can follow the responders. They can follow the crew. They can follow the passengers and see a lot more detail that could not get in the book for space limitations. And there's some actual audio from that time. There's actual film from that. I mean, it's remarkable some of the material that exists, 16mm footage, but thank you so much. Thank you so much, and thank you. I want to give out a real shout out to all the heroes, Good Samaritans, and men and women in uniform, all uniforms,
yeah.
Civilian, and servicemen and women. And again, five Alabamans who were on. I will not say that who survived, but I'm happy to say a majority of them survived.
Eric, thank you so much. His new book, Tiger in the Sea, The Ditching of Flying Tiger 923 and the Desperate Struggle for Survival, it's from Lions Press. That's Lyons Press. And once again, you can check the website, tigerinthesea.com, to find out more about this incredible story and look for the book online and at bookstores everywhere.
Thank you so much for having me. Really appreciate it.
This summer marks the 50th anniversary of Apollo 15, July 25th through August 7th, which makes it the 50th anniversary of the lunar rover being driven on the moon. That's why we're delighted to welcome New York Times bestselling author Earl Swift, whose newest book is Across the Earless Wilds, The Lunar Rover and the Triumph of the Final Moon Landings. It's from Custom House Publishing. Earl, how are you this morning?
Doing well, thanks. How are you doing?
I'm good. I enjoyed your book. What an extraordinary adventure. I remember I was a teenager when all this took place and remember seeing the sketches of the lunar rover and hearing it called the moon buggy on the news media. That NASA wasn't too crazy about that designation, were they?
Well, no, they viewed it as a spacecraft on wheels. So, but, you know, it's a bit difficult to resist given that dune buggies were such a big deal at the time. Press couldn't resist playing on that.
Absolutely. This was the result of a number of people, one or two of them we might have heard of, but most of them are people that sadly through time the names have been lost, that you talk about in your book, Across the Airless Wild.
Well, the longest presence in this story belongs to a group of engineers who were never household names, but who were the real brains behind not only the lunar rover, but much of the entire Apollo program and actually its predecessors. But that's the case with the entire space program. You had 400,000 people employed by it, both at NASA and its private side contractors. And, the only public face, really, belonged to the astronauts. So we as a public saw the users of the space program, not the people responsible for the gear and the planning to do all those amazing things. It was fun to tell the story just to get some of those behind-the-scenes folks front and center.
Right. Guys like Greg Becker and Frank Pavlik's that I read about. It's interesting that the two of them and Wernher von Braun were guiding forces behind this, and all of them were immigrants into the United States, which kind of has a nice ring to it about us being a nation of immigrants.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, if you were to go through those 400,000 people employed in the space program back in the 60s, I think you'd find that there are a great number of immigrants on the payrolls and an even greater number of people who were first-generation Americans whose parents wound up coming here from elsewhere.
Right.
So Frank Pavlik and Greg Becker, both of whom worked for General Motors and helped develop the lunar rover, their boss was a guy named Sam Romano, whose parents had moved from Italy. They're great examples of the whole, really.
They didn't have very long to develop this. Most of the space program was let's see how fast we can get this done because we have to get to beat the Soviets to the moon. And now that we're there, what are we going to do? So it seemed like the window of time that it took to come up with, and there were a number of prototypes, weren't there? This is the one that made it is not the only one that was ever considered.
True. You got to make a distinction here between the many, many years from which they talked about it and then the very, very small window of time in which they finally decided, okay, we got to build this thing and get it aboard a lunar module now. You can go all the way back to 1952 in terms of their talking about it, and there were a number of prototypes that NASA came up with, a lot of different studies that it funded, but eventually budget cuts killed all that, and it looked like there was going to be no rover at all until General Motors, again, Frank Pavlik and Sam Romano, came to Wernher von Braun at the Marshall Space Flight Center with a prototype of a tiny little featherweight go-kart that folded like a business letter to slide aboard the lunar module. And that's really where it began. And they had to develop the thing and build it and test it in 17 months, which was less than half the time that NASA hardware usually took. So it was a breakneck effort. It was frantic.
And I didn't realize this until I read your book, that astronauts had the opportunity to train in specific sites, but also all around the world in learning how to be geologists, because the astronauts that were going to the moon weren't geologists. They were mostly test pilots and engineers and such, right?
Yeah, well, with one exception, they were all test pilots. And that one exception was on the last Apollo mission, Jack Schmidt. He was a geologist, but geology was the science that made the most sense to pursue. It offered the greatest opportunity for insight into Earth history, the solar system's history, along with the moon's. And so beginning with 15, especially, the astronauts were very well trained, to the point where, their training was comparable to that achieved by a master's student. So, they went all over the world. They went to Iceland. They went to Hawaii. They went to the nuclear test site in Nevada, studying the effects of meteor strikes, looking for different styles of rock that they might encounter on the moon, being able to identify what they were looking at, and they became really good scientists.
They also did not know how thick the dust was going to be on the moon. I remember one passage talking about they were concerned that people would sink down in 10 feet of dust or something, and how are they going to work around that? Happily enough, that's not what they found.
That was especially a worry in the 1950s, and it was a serious worry. There was a theory that the lunar dust was unconsolidated, that is, it was loose, and that might be a couple thousand feet thick, and so any landing spacecraft would just disappear from view the second we'd just keep going and sink into this dry lunar quicksand. Of course, it was pretty much theoretically disproven by the time the Surveyor program sent soft landing probes onto the lunar surface.
Right.
But that settled it once and for all.
Earl, it's a really fascinating book. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Earl Swift, the author of Across the Airless Wilds, The Lunar Rover and the Triumph of the Final Moon Landings, from Custom House. It's available at bookstores and online everywhere as we observe the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 15 mission and the first time that human beings, American astronauts, drove around on the moon. We're talking today to Mark Shaw, the author of Collateral Damage, The Mysterious Deaths of Marilyn Monroe, JFK, and Dorothy Kilgallen, and the ties that bind them to Robert Kennedy and the JFK assassination. I found your book really interesting. I've got to be honest, I've read dozens of books about the Kennedy assassination and on all sorts of angles to it, but this is the very first one. I started to hear something kind of a whisper a year or so ago about the connection with Dorothy Kilgallen, and for most baby boomers, they might remember her as a frequent guest on What's My Line and stuff like that, but you have done the research to link the peculiarity of the deaths of these within 40 months, and you say that the key to all that is the appointment of Bobby Kennedy as Attorney General. So tell us how this theory developed.
Well, thank you, Doc. I never intended really to write this book. I'd written that bestseller about Dorothy Kilgallen, The Reporter Knew Too Much. I wrote a book about Joe Kennedy. You know, I'd exposed the Ruby trial transcripts, Dorothy Kilgallen being at the trial and interviewing Ruby and all that. I was going to quit. But an awful lot of people kept asking me, supporters of mine and readers of the books around the world, is there a connection between the deaths of Dorothy Kilgallen, who people may remember on What's My Line, but also she was an investigative reporter called the most powerful female voice in America during the 50s and 60s. Is there a connection between her death, because she had investigated the JFK assassination, and I proved in the book that she was murdered when she got too close to the truth, and the death of Marilyn Monroe? And I didn't think there was, even though there is, within 40 months, as you said, and this is a real shocker for people, we lost Marilyn Monroe in 62, JFK in 63, and Dorothy Kilgallen in 65. So I started looking into it, and I think the same curiosity that I had, what I believe I've done is resolve three true crime murder mysteries in this book. And how that happened is that I first found that Dorothy Kilgallen and Marilyn Monroe were very good friends. And Dorothy had written many columns about Marilyn, both before she died and afterwards. And she praised her, and she talked about, you know, what an incredible actress she was, overcoming gender discrimination and becoming, you know, probably the most famous woman in the world at one particular point, this beautiful woman. And so I found that relationship. And then, unfortunately, I came across a column that she wrote after Marilyn died, and it talked about this relationship she had with Bobby Kennedy. Now, most people, and I was one of them, remember that she had the affair with JFK after she sang happy birthday to him, remember, on his birthday and all of that.
Right.
But very few people knew about the Jack Kennedy, about the Bobby Kennedy affair. And so as I started to look into this, and Dorothy gave me the clue, talked about the relationship after JFK dumped Marilyn. Joe Kennedy told him to, and so that was over, and along came Bobby. And he was kind of like a little puppy dog, my research has showed. You know, Bobby, Joe Kennedy had his, you know, his trophy actress, Gloria Swanson, that he, you know, was with. JFK had, you know, Jackie, and then Marilyn. Well, Bobby Kennedy wanted a trophy. Mm. And so he started seeing Marilyn when he was in L.A. working on a movie based on one of his books about the mafia, and he was with her all the time, either at her home or at Peter Lawford's beachfront home and all of that. And basically, you know, Marilyn fell in love with him too, this powerful man, this attorney general, and believed, and it's hard for anybody like us to believe, that he was going to divorce Ethel Kennedy and marry her. And so in the book, I prove that that was what her mindset was as she went into August of 1962. So this made me curious about whether she would have been suicidal at that particular point. But as you remember, what the official verdict was, she committed probable suicide. Would that have happened? Would what Bobby Kennedy have done put her in that state of mind? Because Dorothy had written about her that she was in good spirits. She was waiting on a Broadway play that she was going to do. She might marry Joe DiMaggio if it didn't work out with RFK and all of that. And so I looked first at the autopsy report, and it said that she died of an overdose of drugs. And then I looked at her certificate of death a few days later, and they changed it to probable suicide. And that made me really wonder about what happened. So I looked into the forensics involving her death, and they were all across the board. There were real question marks, and Dorothy Kilgallen wrote another column asking all these questions about, you know, how could she have ingested 40 to 50 pills from the time that she would have done that to her death. That was impossible. I confirmed that with a detective who wondered about it. Right. Why was the light on under her door? She always slept in the dark. Why was she nude? She never slept in the nude. Dorothy asked all these questions, and so I asked the same questions, and I then came back to the fact that I believe that Marilyn, you know, had been silenced. Well, who had the motive to do that? Well, apparently from a CIA document that I found that was issued the day before Marilyn died, Marilyn had made a huge mistake. At an event up near the California-Nevada border, she was there with the Kennedys, she was there with Frank Sinatra, she was there with a number of people, and she found out that Bobby was not going to marry her, and also that they might even videotape some of her. If she had sex with the Kennedys, that might be videotaped, and she just went mad. Mm. She screamed. She tried to get DiMaggio to come get her, and then she made a statement that actually cost her life, and it's right in the CIA document. It says the subject, Marilyn, threatened to hold a press conference and tell all. Mm. You know, that would give us the feeling that she was going to expose the relationships with both Kennedys, which would have been bad enough. But this document says the subject also made references to bases in Cuba and knew of the president's plan to kill Castro. Mm. So apparently both JFK and RFK shared national secrets with her. And you can imagine that Bobby Kennedy could not let her issue a press conference. So I kept thinking, motive-wise, who has the motive to have eliminated Marilyn Monroe if, in fact, she was murdered? So I looked then at the situation that happened right around Marilyn's death. And basically, I was able to show that on the day that Marilyn died, Bobby Kennedy was in Los Angeles with Peter Lawford. They went to Marilyn's home and begged her not to hold a press conference or go to the media. She refused. And then it was just a logical conclusion that Bobby couldn't let this happen. And using operatives of his, they went ahead and orchestrated Marilyn's death.
Wow. The supposition then becomes, if he had been prosecuted, if this had been revealed at that point in 1963, that might have prevented his brother being assassinated, because one of the collateral damages of JFK being killed is that now his brother is basically toothless from that point forward. And it's going to take him almost 5 years to get back to a position where he really has enough clout to do something about it. This is not the first time I have read that one of the reasons that John Kennedy died was to neutralize Bobby Kennedy. Mm-hmm. But this is the first time that I've read the reason would be because of this previously existing relationship with Marilyn Monroe. That's pretty startling.
Well, it is, and it shocked me as well. You know, Dorothy Kilgallen was the most credible reporter to have covered the JFK assassination, and in The Reporter Who Knew Too Much, I proved that, you know, she interviewed Jack Ruby at his trial. You know, she spent 18 months looking into the investigation. Whatever Ruby told her, she went to New Orleans where there was a mafia Don Carlos Marcello. And that connected because Joe Kennedy ordered JFK to appoint Bobby Kennedy attorney general. That was a double cross because those same mafioso had helped JFK win the election. And Joe's promise was, you help us win the election, we'll leave you alone. Well, the first thing Bobby did was deport Marcello and accuse him of racketeering. And you can't mess around with those guys.
No.
And so Marcello and his cohorts said, well, look, we could kill JFK. I mean, we could kill Bobby Kennedy, who I hate, but JFK will come after everything we have, you know, come after us with everything the government has. So we killed JFK, and Bobby Kennedy is powerless. Well, if Bobby Kennedy would have been prosecuted for the death of Marilyn Monroe, then he would have been powerless, as you say. And there wouldn't have been any JFK assassination. You stretch that to 65, and Dorothy Kilgallen would not have been killed because she wouldn't have had an investigation, an assassination to investigate. It all fits together, I believe.
Mark Shaw, thank you so much for being with us today on WTBF.
Thank you so much.
Our thanks again to Mark Shaw, the author of Collateral Damage, The Mysterious Deaths of Marilyn Monroe, JFK and Dorothy Kilgallen, and the Ties That Bind Them to Robert Kennedy and the JFK Assassination. So there you go. We've been talking to Eric Lindner, his book Tiger in the Sea, Eric Swift, his book about the 50th anniversary of the Moon Rover, and Mark Shaw, Collateral Damage. Thanks so much for joining us on The Bookshelf. We'll see you next time right here on your favorite radio stations and your favorite podcast. Until then, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Thanks for listening, and God bless.